Item one, does corporate America keep its word? Item two, black capitalism now and historically. And item three, mac and cheese. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 19th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We go back today to 19 August a year ago and what seemed at the time to be a vaguely seismic change in the way companies in this economy behave. Specifically, a declaration by the Business Roundtable, the CEOs of some of the biggest and most powerful companies in this economy, that they were going to redefine, and this is a quote, the purpose of a corporation. Instead of creating value just for shareholders, they were going to start creating value for all stakeholders, customers and employees, the environment and communities too. So a year on, it seems fair to ask, how's that been going? Tyler Rye is a professor of management at Wharton. Welcome to the program.
Very happy to be here, Kai.
So this is going to sound weird, but do you listen to The Daily from the New York Times?
I do not.
Okay. Well, first of all, you might want to check it out. It's really good. But I was walking the dogs this morning and I was listening, and one of the ads, underwriting, we call it here in public radio land, was by the Business Roundtable. And they said, when the pandemic hit, the Business Roundtable and our companies took action to make sure we were living up to the commitments we made a year ago. That's a paraphrase, but that's basically the gist of it. What did you find when you looked into this?
I found that in general, the signatories to the Business Roundtable statement did no better than any other companies in the S&P 500 when the pandemic hit. And if you dig a little bit deeper, the companies that were returning the most money to shareholders before signing the BRT statement, they had by far the worst responses to the pandemic out of any companies in the S&P 500.
So break that down a little bit, especially that last bit about returning money to shareholders. Let's explain what the Business Roundtable promise or pledge, I suppose, was designed to do.
Sure. So the Business Roundtable statement on the purpose, redefining what a corporation is, what they were doing was trying to move away from pure, unadulterated shareholder capitalism, where the only purpose of the company was to make money for its shareholders. And so the statement said, we need to prioritize all stakeholders, put them on equal footing with our shareholders, and not just try and return money to the people who own our stock through buybacks or dividends.
And how did they do before the pandemic? I mean, were they living up to that?
I think that's the most interesting thing that we found in our data. We found that the companies who signed the statement actually did start to change their behavior in ways that aligned with what was in the statement. So we saw them returning less capital to shareholders, less dividend or lowering their dividends, less buybacks, and taking steps to be more stakeholder oriented. So between when they signed the statement and when the pandemic hit, it seemed like the statement was worth more than the paper it was printed on.
All right. So this is an oversimplification, but when the pandemic hit, did they just go, hey, man, we got to survive. And sorry about that promise we made.
You know, I think it's a little bit more complicated than that, because when you look at any firm in the S&P 500, they could have had that same response, right? It was the shock was felt equally across these companies, obviously different across industries. But when you look comparing BRT firms in the same industries, you see different responses. So I don't think it was, you know, sorry, the statement is just out the window. You know, this is something existential we have to deal with. You know, I think there was something going on with this change that they were trying to make. And then when they encountered the shock, you know, it led to a different type of behavior.
Well, and that behavior includes more layoffs and things that companies were doing, you know, back in March and April when we all thought the world was ending, you know?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So layoffs, furloughs, a range of indicators. We saw these companies not doing as much as some of their S&P 500 peers.
What do you suppose this conversation would be like on this anniversary had the pandemic not happened? Would they still be making that progress that they were in the beginning?
You know, it's tough to say. My guess is, based on how things were trending, that we'd be talking about, you know, some reasonable success in terms of, you know, shifting behavior in ways that lined up with the statement. Now, that said, if we just compare the signatories to this statement with a match sample of S&P 500 firms, they're much more likely to behave badly just as a baseline before any of this happened anyway. So their behavior was ticking in the right direction, but they still had a ways to go even to sort of get to neutral.
Tyler Rye is a professor of management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Rye, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Very happy to be here, Kai.
Remember we talked yesterday about the commingled good and bad economic news this pandemic is bringing? Here's another item. Some of the most expensive rental markets in the country are getting less expensive. Rents in San Francisco are down as much as 12% from a year ago. New York City is down 7%. Boston, San Jose, Miami, and Honolulu, similar if smaller declines. All of this, by the way, according to the apartment search company Zumper. And yes, there is a whole lot of economic pain in those numbers. Lost jobs and incomes, people having to move back in with family or doubling up with roommates. But for those who choose to see the silver lining in that rental market cloud, there is some opportunity too, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Amanda Cass renewed her lease in Menlo Park, California, back in February, thinking she was getting a good deal because the landlord wasn't raising the rent.
And little did we know how much things would change in just a month.
When a neighbor in her building moved out last month,
the unit he had been in rented for 20% less than he had been paying, and that was after it sat vacant for a month.
Her neighbor worked in tech and could do his job remotely, which is one reason some of the biggest rent declines have been in Silicon Valley. But economist Igor Popov with Apartment List says tourist towns like Orlando and Honolulu are also seeing rents fall because people are losing their jobs.
Because so many of those jobs, they can never go remote. So they've had a hard time during the shelter-in-place era.
Nationally, real estate firm CBRE predicts multifamily rents will fall by about 8% this year and not fully recover until 2022. Bob Penninger with the National Apartment Association says it could get worse if more people end up out of work.
The unknown is what is going to be the economic fallout that we haven't seen yet.
But the flight from cities may be overstated. Zillow found that rents in Kansas City, Detroit, and Baltimore are growing, and faster than in the suburbs. The company's economist, Joshua Clark, says it's tempting to imagine urbanites fleeing to the suburbs for good. He himself left his Seattle apartment to live with family in Westchester County in New York.
But I think what we're seeing right now is a temporary shift. I think we're seeing a lot of people who can move out of the city that will return to the city once things go back to normal and their favorite bar, restaurant, museums start to open up again.
And those who do go back might be able to score a deal on the rent. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Wednesday, a little weak, kind of droopy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Four days after George Floyd was killed by police in Minnesota, the fashion designer and business owner Aurora James posted a call out to retailers on her Instagram. If those retailers really wanted to support the black community, she said, they would pledge to devote 15% of their shelf space to black-owned businesses, because nearly 15% of the U.S. population is black. Some big companies have signed on. Sephora and West Elm are two of them. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra checked in with James to see how it's going.
Aurora James, founder of the shoe and handbag company Brother Vellies, says the 15% pledge was born out of frustration.
I was seeing all of these emails and posts on Instagram from these businesses that said, "We stand with you and we support you." And as a black woman and a black entrepreneur, I really wasn't feeling like they were standing with me or supporting me.
So she said, "Show me." She quickly started a 15% pledge website and created a nonprofit, and companies started to sign on. James is asking retailers to take three steps. First, figure out what percentage of your products are made by black-owned businesses. Second, figure out how you got there. Like maybe you're not incentivizing your buyers to seek out different brands.
maybe people have spent so much time buying Michael Kors, there's like no space to, you know, try buying a Christopher John Rogers or, you know, another Black-owned brand.
The third step, come up with a plan to get to 15%. Artemis Patrick is an executive at Sephora, which took the pledge.
The people that are buying beauty, they are diverse, and they deserve to be buying products from founders that look like them and have the same beauty needs.
The company has found that only 7 of the 290 brands it sells are Black-owned. Patrick says Sephora plans to address the barriers many Black business owners face, like access to capital.
We will be providing connections to and support from funders so that these companies have the financial resources they need and unfortunately often don't have access to.
James says retailers could also give deposits to small business owners up front so they can make the products. A few other companies have signed on to the pledge: West Elm, Rent the Runway, and the cannabis dispensary MedMen. And James says there's a business case for more retailers to do the same.
I, as a Black woman, know that I'm no longer comfortable shopping at retailers that aren't committing to my community.
She says other shoppers are paying attention, too. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
There was a headline a couple of weeks ago, maybe you saw it, that Kraft Heinz, the processed food conglomerate, is going to rebrand its eponymous macaroni and cheese. For just a limited time, the company is replacing the word dinner on those blue and yellow boxes with breakfast, because mac and cheese is a breakfast food now, I guess. It's a pandemic. There are no rules. But in all seriousness, this is just the latest chapter in the history of a food that's had shelf space in the American pantry for generations. Jeffrey Miller is a professor of hospitality management at Colorado State, and here with his ode to macaroni and cheese.
Macaroni and cheese is a very old food. We have recipes that are 700 years old for macaroni and cheese. The Neapolitans, the people who gave us that great pizza, also gave us macaroni and cheese. But this product that is so ubiquitous on the marketplace today, we owe it all to James Kraft.
Home-cooked dinners, the quick kind you cook up fresh.
As I jokingly tell my own students, we like to curse processed foods, but we usually do it with a mouth full of them.
You know, feeding a whole ball team isn't too big a job when you have Kraft macaroni and cheese dinner handy.
The original formulation for macaroni and cheese came out of the Depression.
Costs only a nickel a serving.
It was always sold as a value food, a cheap way to feed your family quickly. What really made macaroni and cheese take off, however, was the rationing in World War II.
With most meat going to feed the biggest army in U.S. history, a series of meatless Tuesdays went into effect.
Macaroni and cheese cost one ration point, which was not much even then. So you'd spend one of your ration points, you'd spend a few cents on a box of macaroni and cheese, and it was a center-of-the-plate item that you could feed your family.
Okay, boys, come and get it.
Kraft home-cooked dinner.
Foods like macaroni and cheese were very liberating for women.
I have a problem. It's my husband. He comes home for lunch.
Most women spent a lot of time in the kitchen preparing three meals a day for their families. They were very open to something that would give them some free time to concentrate on something else.
Kraft macaroni and cheese dinner. New hope for wives who took their husbands for better or worse.
I'd get them for lunch, too.
Women, as a result of processed foods and convenience foods, are able to enter professions, were able to have more hobbies, etc., etc. And so it was very well received by them. Processed foods were considered to be a blessing by a lot of people. People really like processed foods. It's just kind of fashionable to say that they don't. Processed foods are as big, if not bigger, than ever. A lot of us had our lives upended by the coronavirus without question. And I heard a lot of people say that, oh, isn't this great? Americans are getting back to cooking and, you know, they're going to appreciate home-cooked food. And I just don't think that's true. It's a hobby for some middle-class people, but I think we still want the convenience that goes with somebody preparing our food for us. And so that happy medium right now is macaroni and cheese and box foods and things like that.
Professor Jeffrey Miller at Colorado State University in defense on this program of macaroni and cheese. Coming up.
The funding is slow to come. And in many ways, this is a sort of chicken and egg sort of problem.
When you can't have one thing without the other. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 85 points today, 0.3%, 27,692. The NASDAQ down 64, 0.5%, 11,146. The S&P 500 declined 14 points, about 0.4%, 33.74. As some companies and industries suffer, others prosper. Here's one. Target's CEO said, "We are spending more at his stores." Partially, he said, because of canceled vacations, I'll buy that. Closed movie theaters? Nah, I don't know. Anyway, a couple of numbers from Target's latest quarterly report. 24% increase in overall sales. 70% rise in electronic sales compared to a year ago. I buy that. 10 million new online customers. Target shares boosted more than 12%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This has not been a very good week for college campuses that had opened for in-person classes. On Monday, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, moved all of its classes online after more than 100 students tested positive for COVID. Notre Dame did the same thing yesterday. Michigan State has scrapped in-person classes before they have even started. That obviously is not what most students signed up for, and some of them are talking refund. But as Marketplace's Eric Barris reports, that is not going to be easy.
So college doesn't look like what you thought it would. Can you get your tuition back? According to Sandy Baum, who studies higher education at the Urban Institute, the rules are all over the place.
So there is no uniform policy about under what circumstances students would be owed tuition because of these unanticipated changes.
Every college sets its own policy. Some won't refund a penny. Others will do a partial refund up to a certain point in the semester. Still others are handing out vouchers for future tuition. If that's too much uncertainty for you, how about an insurance policy? Some insurers offer coverage that reimburses students for tuition if they get COVID-19 and have to leave school. John Fees is the co-founder of GradGuard, an insurance company that works with 366 schools. He says he's been pretty busy.
We have more than 100,000 customers, which is more than doubled from last year.
Colleges like those insurance policies, says Mark Kantrowitz, who runs the website Saving for College.
The college gets the benefit of knowing that they're going to still get their bills paid by the family, even if the student is forced to withdraw.
And you could go to court. There are already more than 200 lawsuits against institutions of higher learning regarding tuition refunds. Christopher Marsicano, who runs the College Crisis Initiative at Davidson College, says he doesn't think the lawsuits will amount to much because
these institutions are still providing an education, even if it wasn't the one that we all wanted to have happen.
And he says if you aren't happy with your refund or lack thereof, you can always take your business elsewhere. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
We've been talking a lot about systemic racism in this economy and what we can and ought to do about it. And one part of that has to be what the government can do. And there is a lesson, as there so often is, in history. Back in the late 1960s, a civil rights leader by the name of Floyd McKissick had an idea. A new town built from the ground up in rural north central North Carolina, built by and for black people, called Soul City. The town would be built, as I said, by and for black people.
Which was to be designed to be sort of a showcase of black capitalism.
That's Devin Fergus. He teaches history and black studies at the University of Missouri. Floyd McKissick, the guy with the idea, had served in World War II. He'd seen the success of the Marshall Plan in rebuilding Europe. And he thought to himself, what if we used government money to fix the problems poor black people were facing in the American South? He gets support up to and including from President Richard Nixon on the condition that he change one thing.
His original imagination was this was going to possibly be an all-black project. But then the federal government stepped in and said that this would be a violation, basically, of the Civil Rights Act of 64, that if you're going to have, want the federal government to be involved in, then you must open it up to all sort of communities. And McKissick was said fine. But it's designed to have a disparate positive impact on communities of color, particularly African Americans.
So this is a little sideways, but roll with me here. This is the federal government in the substance and policy arm of it, giving money to try to fix a problem that arguably, not really arguably, I guess, the federal government had created, right? The systemic economic disempowerment of a huge fraction of its population. What eventually happens with Soul City?
Sure. So what eventually happens with Soul City is that the funding is slow to come. And in many ways, this is a sort of chicken and egg sort of problem. So the federal government says, if you want the federal government to allocate much of the financial resources, then you must get formal written commitments from industry. So without the federal government's initial financial commitment, industry won't commit. With industry not committing, a workforce won't come into the area to relocate. Mm. So this is a long sort of standoff.
Yeah. So you're a professor of history. I don't know how much you like to dabble in counterfactuals, but what if Soul City had worked? What would that have looked like?
In some ways, it would have looked like an additive to what we've seen in the past couple of decades, and that is a remigration of African Americans south. And this is in part what Soul City was designed to do. And with that, it could have brought in a more robust working and middle class population. African Americans, but not exclusively African Americans, to the South. And in many ways, it may have created almost a synergy with a place called the RTP, Research Triangle Park, which is also located in North Carolina and is known as a sort of a major hub of investment and industry, particularly in the areas of science and technology. And so it could have perhaps created this almost synergy with the RTP area. Again, that did not happen. Really to great disappointment, rather than perhaps Jesse Helms and others working closely with Soul City to make it a success and to bring in industry and tax revenue into that area, they worked to undermine it.
What does this episode tell us about the government's ability to fix these big systemic problems? And does it, do you think, do more harm or more good when it tries?
Well, it shows that government helped to create many of these problems initially, but government also has a possibility to help ameliorate them. Even McKissick himself, greatly frustrated by the bureaucracy and red tape, by the ways in which his hands were tied and how he wanted to basically bring in industry first, but could not because government created all these other stipulations. Despite all these complaints that McKissick had, he also fully appreciated and valued that government was key and critical to really addressing problems of Black economic precarity. So and I think he's largely accurate there in that the problems which hamstrung McKissick, i.e. problems of access to capital, still hamstring many Black entrepreneurs and Black business communities and leaders today. It is access to capital, which makes government so critical and essential.
Devin Fergus, professor of history, Black studies, public policy at the University of Missouri. Professor, thanks for your time, sir. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
We did an hour special about the racial wealth gap in this country and, more to the point, how to close it. It's airing on some local public radio stations. You can also hear it online, marketplace.org. Go to the Economy What Now page. As final note on the way out, you have heard probably that Apple was, for a couple of hours today, worth $2 trillion, closed at a relatively cheap, I suppose, $1.98 trillion in market capitalization, but you get the point. That would make it if, A, Apple were a country, and B, gross domestic product was a one-off, so bear with me here. But Apple at $2 trillion would be, depending on the list you use, either the eighth or ninth biggest economy in the world. Okay, we're out of here, but here is your midweek moment of economic context. Another entry in the, yeah, how hard can central banking be anyway file. The Fed released the minutes of its most recent meeting today, the one at the end of July. Lots of analysis and forecasts, as you might imagine. Here, though, is the nut graph. The quote goes like this. Uncertainty surrounding the economic outlook remained very elevated, with the path of the economy highly dependent on the course of the virus and the public sector's response to it. Now, haven't we all been saying that? Right? Our media production team, with a reminder that if this is Wednesday, these are the ones going into the office so the rest of us don't have to. Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, J.C. Bold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.